Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. This week on Meat and Three, we're looking at factors that will shape our food world in 2019. We start with trend predictions and how media covers them.
A website could theoretically devote all their coverage to these viral trends and get all sorts of hits. That's not a way to build sustainable readerships, just as it's not a way to build, you know, sustainable restaurants.
We report on a big change coming and how street meat will be served.
On January 1st, a ban on plastic foam went into effect in New York City.
And we round out the episode with a story about using gene editing to create the spicy tomato of the future.
At first, it sounds like a gimmick or like something that you would do for fun. The truth is, there is a real value behind it.
It's not too late to make your resolution. Subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single episode this year.
Welcome to Food Without Borders, a show about food, politics, and identity. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org. Today, my guests are both Reem Rahim Hassani and Jane French from Numi Organic Tea. Reem is the co-founder and chief brand officer of Numi Organic Tea, one of the fastest growing tea companies in the industry. Reem is a mission-driven entrepreneur who strives to foster a healthy, thriving global community while bringing the public the best, purest tasting organic tea. Jane French is the director of strategic sourcing and sustainability at Numi Organic Tea, where she ensures the ongoing ethical sourcing and premium quality of ingredients while leading sustainable strategy. Welcome to the show, Reem and Jane.
Thank you, Sari.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. You're both calling in on the phone. Are you in Oakland?
I'm in Petaluma, actually.
Okay.
And Jane's in Oakland.
Okay.
I'm in our office in Oakland.
Got it. Okay, so you're very far away from where we are in Bushwick, Brooklyn. So thank you for making the time to speak with us today. Let's just jump right in. I'll start with Reem. You are the co-founder of Numi. You started it with your brother, Ahmed. Can you tell me a little bit about where you both came from, where you grew up, what that was like?
Sure. Well, we were both born in Baghdad, Iraq. And we immigrated to the United States in 1971 and grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, so close to you, so we understand the cold.
I also grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Where about?
Shaker Heights. Yeah. How about you?
Oh, that's where I grew up.
No way!
I swear. Where'd you go to school?
Shaker Heights High School.
That's where my brother went. I went to Hathaway Brown.
Oh, yeah. When did... Sorry, listeners. We got to do this real quick. When did you guys graduate?
I graduated in 84.
Okay.
Probably much older than you.
Just a little bit.
And he graduated in 86.
Yeah.
He graduated in 86.
That's really funny. Well, that's awesome. Well, now I'm really psyched you're on the show.
So we grew up in Cleveland and... You know, we're immigrant family growing up in Cleveland, Ohio. So, you know, that had its positives and negatives, I suppose. And we launched Numi in 1999, and it was inspired by a dried lime we drank as children called Numi from Iraq. And we'd always discussed, bringing it to the United States and that somebody should do it. And then we finally came upon doing it. My brother had owned and operated tea houses in Prague in the Czech Republic. He'd lived there for several years. And I was an artist. And I did the artwork for the packaging, and he did all the blends. And we started in a small apartment in Oakland, and then slowly grew, and, you know, worked our butts off and grew to be where we are today. And so we're distributed across the United States and across 30 countries around the world, and, you know, have so many different products that we sell currently.
Yeah. I'm still a little stuck on the whole Shaker Heights thing. I'm curious. I read a lot about how your family, like, traveled back and forth from Cleveland to Iraq a lot. And I mean, my experience at Shaker was that it was pretty diverse. Was that the same mm-hmm. for you, or did you feel, you know, were there other people who had emigrated from, you know, the Middle East when you were there, or what was that like for you?
Yeah, I think Shaker was pretty diverse. We were on the edge of Shaker and Beachwood, so our street, we were the only
less diverse
Muslims
yeah.
on the street. The rest of the street was all Jewish.
Mm-hmm. My dad was a rabbi in Beachwood.
Yeah, and you know, which was fine, no problem. I think in where I went to school was very, I guess I would say, WASPy, in the sense that most were, you know, white, Caucasian, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, you know, wealthier gals. And I was friends with the Jewish girls, and there was a couple other, it was a little bit lacking diversity when I was growing up there.
What was your choice to go to a private girls' school as opposed to go to a public school, which was, you know, pretty integrated?
Wasn't my choice.
Got it.
My parents' choice.
Right.
So, Ahmed, my brother, was at Gilmore for a couple of years, but he rebelled and got out, so he went to Shaker.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever a feeling of kind of like existing between two different worlds because your family was back and forth
yes.
a lot?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we used to travel every 3-4 years. We used to go to Iraq to see our family, or they would come to visit us in the summer. So we had a lot of contact with them. And I always felt like I was living two different worlds, because inside my home, my parents spoke Arabic. And it was very strongly focused on the culture and food and traditions, and a pretty traditional family. And then outside was a whole different world. So there were, you know, certain things like dating, which was not in, you know, not allowed within my family, at least for the girls, that was normal outside. So, you know, it was a lot of kind of trying to switch identities or trying to figure out how you fit in. That was a big issue for me. It was fitting in, and there was a sense of longing to fit in a lot.
Probably on both sides too. I mean, I imagine you just had to do a lot of compartmentalizing. I mean, just when I
yeah.
picture, I mean, because you say HB, and I just know exactly what you mean. I just picture like a lot of white girls playing field hockey.
Yeah, that's how it was.
Yeah.
And I was on the tennis team. And so, you know, fitting into that and also feeling wouldn't say ostracized, maybe a little bit marginalized, and mm-hmm. people really not understanding or saying things that were discriminating that came back to you in one form or another. You always kind of felt like you're on the outside.
Yeah. Is that part of the reason why you became an artist? Was it just like a way to express yourself?
I think I became an artist for various reasons. Probably one of them, and I did a lot of artwork at HB, and I was in the art classes and kind of was an art star, actually. You know, teachers took me on under their wing. I think my family, the way I was raised, also was kind of, I don't want to say repressive, but just very strict, so that I wanted to break out of that. And then I also come from a family of, my mom's a designer, and she studied art, and I come from a lineage of that. So I think there's a lot of different combinations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually studied engineering as an undergrad. So as an immigrant, you know, at least my family, we were pushed to do things that were more, you know, that gave you stability and you had a career. So studying art was not in the books for me. So I was going to be a doctor, and then I decided to study biomedical engineering. My sister was also an engineer, and my brothers were pushed to do business and engineering, and they actually, my parents didn't talk to them for a couple of years because they studied liberal art.
Wow.
Yeah, not easy.
I guess becoming an entrepreneur and starting this company with Ahmed was a way to kind of satisfy everything. Maybe in some ways, because you still get to be an artist, right? But you're an entrepreneur.
Exactly. So it all kind of came full swing because Ahmed started off his business and then he hated it. And then he studied, ended up going into photography and psychology and drama. And, you know, that was not really acceptable. And then after I finished engineering, I diverted into art. And then we kind of brought it back full circle and, you know, did the thing that would, you know, make sure that we were on our feet financially and steady and all that. Mm-hmm. So
what ways does Numi, I mean, other than the name, which is such like a lovely little story, and are there other ways that it reflects your heritage and your background?
I think that our values are very aligned to our background in the sense that we come from a very, you know, like I'm saying all these things that were very strict and traditional, but yet at the same time, the Arab culture is very open and generous. And our mother especially is still to this day extremely helpful and open and has helped so many refugees and friends. I can't tell you how many people lived at our house because they were fleeing from Iraq. And that sense of generosity, I think, has seeped into the way we do business. So, you know, it's a very open and generous culture that we have in the company. It's a family-oriented culture we have in the family, in the company. And then having left a place that's so war-torn and traveling to different countries, you are exposed to ways of life that you wouldn't be if you just grew up here and you have so much privilege here. You know, you don't see, you know, I mean, you see homeless people, but you don't see beggars as much on the street, and you don't see the poverty that you would see if you travel to, you know, third world countries. And I think that has given us a sense of perspective that people don't have it so good. And, you know, if you're going to make contact with other people, you should help them along the way. It's not just everything for your benefit. So those combinations of my family culture and being exposed to, you know, other cultures, in a lot of ways defined how we relate to others and through the business. And then I would add too that because we've been exposed to a lot of cultures, having being worldly in that sense, it's really important for us to bring these different foods from around the world. I mean, when I'm saying foods, I'm saying tea. So tea is a way to get exposed. Food is a way to get exposed to other cultures, and it's a connection. So I think, you know, importing different teas from all these different communities and cultures around the world gets you exposed to something that you wouldn't otherwise. So mm-hmm. through the business.
And I do want to hear about some of the specific ingredients, but can you talk, and I think Jane can jump in at this point, talk about some of those initiatives you participate in that kind of create the foundation of your company's just value system?
Sure, Jane, you could talk to that a little.
Sure. Yeah. So I think one of the most important things just to begin with is that we are an organics company. So everything that we purchase is organic. And that's extremely important because for a couple of reasons. I mean, one of the reasons it's really important is that the first time the tea leaves or the botanicals are coming into contact with water is when the the tea in your, the water that you pour into the teacup actually infuses those leaves. And so any residues or anything that's on that tea leaf at all is going to go into your cup. So first and foremost, starting with organic, it's just tremendously important. And not only is that important for the consumer, for those who are enjoying that cup of tea, it's also important for the people that are growing that tea and then the watersheds where that tea is coming from. So that also ensures that, you know, the people who are plucking the tea leaves and tending the gardens are also not exposed to those agrochemicals and aren't bringing those home into their houses as well and exposing their families. And then in addition, it's avoiding the agrochemical runoff. So none of those chemicals are running into the local watersheds where they mix in with, you know, the water supply and the food supply.
I had never even thought about that before until I looked at the website for NuMe, like the fact that tea leaves are never, they never have contact with water until they're in a teacup with water.
Yeah. I mean, they're just plucked and they're dried and, depending on the type of tea, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, black tea and green tea and white tea and oolong tea, they all come from the same plant, Camellia sinensis. And depending how that tea leaf is processed after it's been plucked, it turns into a black tea or a green tea or a white tea. So there's various degrees of drying and processing to bring out different flavors in that tea leaf. But at no point is that tea leaf then, you know, kind of washed or you know, kind of cleaned of chemicals before it goes to the consumer. Of course, there is treatment to make sure that it doesn't have, you know, anything that could make anybody sick or anything like that. But the chemicals have been, or, you know, anything that was used to grow the tea leaf will still be there.
Wow.
So, yeah, organics is really important to us, and that's number one. And we also, you know, many of the farms that we work with, too, we select them based on kind of where they're located. So we're really looking for farmers that share our organic values, that are kind of doing it for the right reasons, that put that kind of earth first and, you know, organics first at the forefront of their operations, too. So, for example, one of our green tea suppliers in China was the very first green tea supplier or green tea grower in China to get an organic certificate and to export organic green tea from China. So he really is a pioneer in his field, too, and we have the honor to work with him and the cooperatives that he's helped foster in his community.
How do you find farmers? I'm sorry to interrupt. But how do you cultivate relationships?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, we do a lot of traveling around the world. So, you know, it's really, we get ourselves out there to different opportunities where people gather in the industry. So that's part of it. We also go to Origin many, you know, multiple times a year, but we're visiting our key suppliers almost every year and really getting to know who they are and what their needs are and, you know, really sharing meals with them and, you know, meeting their kids and watching their kids grow up. And so really it's through these trips to Origin and it's hard to explain exactly how the magic happens, but, you know, it's sort of like, you know, when you're out on a trip and like maybe you have a loose agenda of where you think you're going to be going, but you're kind of, you know, your feelers are out there and you're open to possibility. It's kind of really bringing that attitude to the journey. And it's amazing what happens. I mean, you might be in some village and you're talking about, you know, jasmine flowers and somebody walks in and says, oh, you know, have you met this guy? And next thing you know, you're on a road somewhere, you know, to meet the most amazing jasmine flower grower you've ever met, you know?
There's a
certain element of serendipity to it. That's guided by kind of an intention and values.
We had a question that actually came to us for you on Twitter about whether or not the packaging was sustainable and could be composted, because, you know, you have so many different, I mean, just being an organic company, obviously that's sustainability is a major value, but do you want to speak to that? Because I imagine that that's a harder problem.
Yeah, it is a really hard problem, and I'm so glad that that's come up because it's such an important question for our time. You know, I mean, really, you know, ocean plastics and, you know, plastics and all of our bodies and everything. It's just, it's such an important issue. And it's one that we've been working on for many, many years. So we formed in, do you know what year it was, Reem, that, that OSC2 started?
It's been 5 years, I think.
Yeah, so about 5 years ago, Ahmed co-founded a group called OSC2, One Step Closer to an Organic, Sustainable Community, with Laura Dickinson and with some other like-minded brands. And the first question that this industry group kind of took upon themselves was packaging. You know, here we are bringing these beautiful organic fair trade ingredients from all over the world to our consumers in this really mindful, mission-driven way. And they're all wrapped in plastic. And that's a serious problem for the industry. The challenge with it is that, you know, we as a small company, a relatively small company, don't have a lot of clout in the plastics industry. Right. So it's been difficult for us to, you know, to go to the manufacturers of the packaging materials and say, hey, guys, you know, we want to talk about doing this differently. So by forming that group, OSC2, we were able to get enough brands together, you know, brands like Goyaki and Dr. Bronner's and Alter Eco and Lotus Foods and many others. And together we were able to say, hey, look at us now. You know, this is a much bigger market than any one of us standing alone. And we really, truly are interested in compostable packaging, and we need alternatives to this plastic, you know, as soon as possible. And we started with flexible film, which is the plastic that goes over our tea bag. That's the only component of our packaging that still has any plastic in it at all. It's kind of been our last, the last holy grail of, you know, kind of what we need to address. And it's also what covers, you know, your average energy bar or granola bar and, you know, potato chips. You know, that's all this flexible film packaging. It's a really tricky one because it needs to be able to run on manufacturing equipment that has a very strict tolerance in terms of how it can run, the speed it can run, everything like that. And it also needs to provide adequate barrier properties to your food that you're trying to preserve, so that food maintains its quality all the way to the consumer. So that's been a challenge for us too, because we spend all this time searching out these really unique, beautiful, premium, organic, fair trade ingredients. You know, we definitely want them to arrive at our consumers in the best possible condition, so that when they open that bag and they pour that water on, they have a really beautiful experience of the tea. So ensuring that the tea...
Hey, you guys still there?
Tremendously important.
Okay.
So... with these other brands, we got the attention of some of the biggest film companies in the world, because this is a multinational kind of a market, these plastic manufacturers. And we got them to the table to talk to us and have meetings with us about what we wanted. And they actually innovated and have come up with some new materials.
Wow.
So it's really extraordinary.
It is, yeah.
And so we've been piloting a new material. We've done, at this point, we've probably done like 8 or 9 tests at our manufacturing facility. And, you know, the first couple tests, it was, you know, it wouldn't seal properly. It came delaminated, you know, the tea bags popped open, you know. And every time we've learned, and we've learned what to improve and how to improve. And now we have a structure that is completely plant-based. We're really excited about it. We are now working, you know, sort of the challenge we're having is fitting it into the parameters of, you know, what defines compostability, because there are some pretty strict guidelines in terms of the amount of time within which it has to break down. And so our structure is actually in a lab right now, being tested, to meet the guidelines that are required in order to state compostability on the packaging. But we do have a 100% plant-based structure. We sort of feel like we're not over the finish line yet, but we're getting really, really close, and we're really, really excited about it.
but not quite sure yet when it's going to be available.
Okay. Well, we'll stay tuned for that. And it's just so impressive to hear.
I wanted to add to that conversation is another challenge along this is around GMO, mm-hmm. because as you probably know, there's a lot of bioplastics out there, whether they're forks or, you know, forks, knives, you know, bags, you name it. And even tea bags too. There's a lot of see-through pouches that are made out of a bioplastic. Now that bioplastic is made out of a corn residue, or corn, you know, corn, whatever it's called. It's a,
polymer.
Yeah, polymer. And most of the corn, 99% of the corn that's grown is GMO based. So we've been trying to also stay away from anything that is GMO based. So when Jane says it's plant based, she's saying it's plant based that's non GMO.
Right.
So that's a big challenge. And to add sort of a whole umbrella to it is, you know, as we've been going about this sustainability track, I always think that, you know, sustainability isn't an absolute, it's a process.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think of where we've been since the Industrial Revolution and, you know, how much plastic is out there now and how we have to kind of reverse and rewind all the damage that we're doing, it really is a process. So like Jane's saying, you know, the machines will not take a natural material that they're used to. You know, they're used to what they're used to in terms of the materials that have been created for them. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
To be unraveling.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's a monumental task. And the supply chains for those packaging materials are very well established for the conventional sort of, you know, plastic, petroleum-based packaging materials. You know, they've been at it for 50 years perfecting the materials, and we're kind of at the very dawn of these innovative materials. So we feel really proud as a brand to be leading the way in terms of testing materials and actually getting them out there to our production floor and really putting our toe in the water to see what works and what doesn't. The other big challenge, of course, is cost, because, you know, this is a very new material and it really literally costs 100% more than what it is that we're using right now. So another challenge too is kind of fitting it into the overall pie of our costs, you know, and really thinking through how do we find the resources, you know, to allocate to that and then gradually phase it in with the hope that the cost is going to start to come down as more and more people use that material.
Well, it does sound like a monumental undertaking. I mean, it's just kind of overwhelming to think about all the different hurdles you're dealing with. But I really commend you for being so uncompromising and relentless. And, you know, clearly things are actually changing. And it's because of your pursuits. And, you know, innovation doesn't happen overnight, but it's surely happening. And you're a big part of that. So that's really incredible. We're going to take a quick break. And Jane Rehm, please stay with us. And we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. You can rewind, erase, forget my
face. And the sun that's hidden, something remains. You are listening to Food Without Borders on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and we've been chatting with Rehm Rehm Hassani. She's the co-founder of Numi Organic Tea, and Jane French, who's the director of strategic sourcing and sustainability at Numi Organic Tea. Welcome back, both of you. Rehm or Jane or both of you, could you just tell us a little bit about the tea? Like, what are the different flavors, and talk about like where the sourcing comes from and where the inspiration for the flavors come from?
Sure, I could say that. So we have, how many SKUs do we have total? Probably a good 40 or so main ones. We have green teas and black teas. You know, so there's a difference between a traditional Camellia sinensis tea and an herbal tisane, we call it. And those do not have the tea plant in them. So we do have white teas, green teas, black teas, and pu'er teas. And I think we have oolong loose tea. And that comes from the Camellia sinensis plant, which is grown predominantly in Southeast Asia. There are some Camellia sinensis that are plants that grow in Africa too. But these ones are from, the ones that we source are from India, China, Japan. And we have specific gardens that we source from there, and I think maybe even Taiwan. So the blends, the original blends that we did were just straight blends, like a gunpowder green, which is a green tea that's rolled into small little pellets, a jasmine green, which is a scented green tea, an Earl Grey. We started off with very kind of standard, not standard, but, you know, the your staple teas that you would have. We have a Yunnan black tea, which comes from Yunnan, China, and a breakfast blend tea. So all the kind of staple green, black teas. Then we branched out into pu'er teas a number of years ago. And pu'er is a fermented tea, also from China. It grows in a particular region in China, and they grow on 500-year-old tea trees, which is the way tea used to grow before they harvested them into bushes. And those, they're processed in a very unique way, in the sense that they're piled up instead of being laid out to dry or rolled or curled, and then heat processed like either in a wok or through some sort of heat mechanism, which stops the tea leaf from oxidizing. And when we say oxidizing, basically means being exposed to oxygen and getting darker and darker. So the pu'er teas are laid and they're piled, and then they're left for, you know, 30 to 60 days in their turn. So they basically kind of, it's almost like a compost process where they start to ferment, and you get all kinds of amazing probiotic benefits from that tea. Hmm. And it's known to break down cholesterol, known to break down fat. It also provides you with a lot of energy, and supposed to be good for digestion. So there's a lot of great benefits that, people have been waking up to with pu'er. And it's a great alternative to coffee as well. Those are the main teas that we get, and those are from China and India mostly. And then we have a number of herbals and those are just herbs. You know, there's thousands and thousands of herbs that grow all over the world. And we have, we get, for example, our dry desert lime, which grows in Oman. We've got our mint and chamomile, which come from Egypt. Our rooibos and honeybush from South Africa. I'm missing so many. And then we have lots of interesting blends. So we do some chocolate teas that use real cocoa. We get our cocoa from Peru. We have a line of holistic teas, which are more kind of beneficial herbs, healthy and beneficial herbs, that like moringa and guayusa. Moringa comes from Africa, and guayusa comes from Central America. So these particular herbs kind of have specific functions that they do for you. Tulsi comes from India, and so forth. What am I missing, Jane? Going through my mind. Turmeric. Oh, yes, of course. Oh, I can't believe I forgot turmeric. And then turmeric comes from Madagascar, and that's been a really healthy leading root, of course, that helps with inflammation. And we've been getting that from Madagascar. And, you know, along those lines, we do different projects on the gardens that help the farmers. And in Madagascar in particular, we have our Together for Hope project, where we built about 24 wells for the villagers there that have never had access to clean, safe drinking water before. And they were collecting their water from the dirty rivers. And we implemented our Together for Hope project there.
Wow.
So we're always trying to do whatever we can, you know, to kind of bring it full circle to have, you know, from farmer to cup, you know, there's benefits along the way.
Yeah. I mean, you do so much and your brother Ahmed does so much. And I just have to ask how it feels like, as, you know, two people who both are from Iraq and growing up in a very traditional Iraqi family. How has the experience for you been? I mean, you've achieved so much success and you just do so much good with your company, listening to the administration in the past 2 years, just with so much anti-immigrant rhetoric and, you know, banning people coming here from so many countries in the Middle East. Like, I mean, how has that just affected you and your sense of self or not?
It makes me really sad. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, obviously kind of paints immigrants as criminals, you know, especially come from the southern border and all over, you know, whether they're Arabs and they're terrorists or they're Mexicans. And it's really sad.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the people who have, you know, people have come here from all over the world and have added so much to this country, as we know. And, you know, there's the whole illegal conversation and coming here legally. And I get that piece, yet it doesn't go into the nuances. It just blankets all immigrants as, kind of, a burden, I would suppose. And I don't think that's the case. And I think, and I think the country is richer because of all the immigration that's here. And, So I just find it really sad. And the other thing that I think is interesting, too, is people want to come here because they want to better their lives and they want to improve their lives. And they come to add to the country. They don't come to take away from the country. That's one. And most people don't actually want to leave their country. They have no choice. Yeah. You know, there's war and there's poverty and they're fleeing from something. You know, if they had the choice, I think my parents had the choice, they would have stayed put. So there's so much more complexity than the way it's being kind of just, whitewashed. I don't know what you want to call it. It's it's not fair, I think, at the end of the day.
Well, I agree. And thank you for sharing.
And people who come here are so blessed and fortunate. I mean, I love this country and I feel so fortunate to have grown up here. And I think that needs to be recognized. You know, we're all fortunate to be here. So we all uphold all the values and all the, you know, all the things that we together form here. So,
Well, it sounds like, you know, your contributions and Ahmed's contributions have been immense. And just, you know, hearing about your mom is so moving, the way she's helped so many refugees come to this country. So I'm really glad we got to talk today. And your products are incredible. Tell us where we can find them.
Sure. You can find them at natural food grocery stores across the country, Whole Foods, Sprouts, any of the natural food stores. I'm not sure what's in your area. Also a lot of the mainstream grocery stores like Safeway and Kroger's and, all those types of stores too. Target as well. There's some different SKUs at Walmart too. Lots of coffee shops, lots of universities.
Once
you know about it, then you'll start seeing it everywhere.
Yeah. Where can we follow you online?
We're on Facebook and Instagram and, of course, numit.com.
Great. Well, Reem and Jane, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. Thank you, everyone out there, for listening and downloading. We'll be back next week, Wednesday, 6 p.m.
Eastern, or find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and heritageradionetwork.org.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.